The date is June 20th, 1980, and we're watching The Blues Brothers. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
And welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the Jake to my Elwood.
Hello, I'm Colin Stewart.
And this week, we brought back one of our favorite guests that we have on this show, a young man that started off as just another podcaster out there, but I like to think of him as my friend now, Mr. Frank Driscoll.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Colin. It is great to be back on this show. And I thought of something the other day. I realized this is where I enter the Five Timers Club.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Your jacket is in the mail.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping the cigar, too.
Yeah, that's right. So now, I brought you on this show because you have talked about on your own show, Frankfully Honest, that The Blues Brothers is your favorite movie of all time. Was all time what you said? That, like, this is the number one movie?
You know, actually, now that I think about it, I can probably think of it as my favorite of all time.
Yeah.
And I can't remember exactly what I said, but, yeah. But yes, I do love this movie to death. And, it all started when I was about a freshman in high school. Like, I had always known about the film and other things, but I just got an interest in it somehow. I think I watched something and I just figured I should probably watch it in full, because from then I'd seen bits and pieces. So I was looking on my cable box and I found it on the Cinemax channel. So I recorded it then so I wouldn't have to pay for it. And I watched it and I watched it again and again. And again, and it got me to the point in thinking about getting a friend of mine and having us tour like that as impression artists to make money. It didn't work out, but but I've grown
never
such
too
a love.
Late.
Yes. But I've grown such a love for the film. I love every minute of it, and I'm really glad to talk about it.
Right.
Like,
on.
If you would have done the act, which of the brothers would you have been?
You know, I think I have a bits and pieces of both. I think I have the raspy voice of Jake and the legwork of Elwood, so I'd probably find some mixture. I don't know who the other guy would be. We'd have to agree. But
yeah.
It's something to think about now, because now I want to go back and do it. You got me inspired, Colin.
There you go. I mean, I would have had you pegged as Jake, I think.
Well, yeah, but Elwood does have the more fun dancing. Like, he looks like he's having more fun out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, isn't Jake the one that does, like, the backflips through the church?
Oh, that's
yeah.
True. That's true. Yeah.
Well, I promise I can't do a backflip.
Well, this week we are looking back at June 1980 when the movies in theaters were, well, The Motherfucking Empire Strikes Back, The Shining, The Outsider, Urban Cowboy, and here's a bonus because this one is such a fun title. It's an Adam West movie I've never heard of. The Happy Hooker Goes to Hollywood.
How could you decide when you're at the theater? I mean, geez.
That's right. Well, and of course, our movie for today, The Blues Brothers, which earned $115.2 million on a $27.5 million budget. I took it to the inflation calculator. That's about $401 million on a $96 million budget by 2022 money.
Yeah. Decent.
Wow.
I have to assume that most of that budget went to the wrecked cars and the cocaine. because allegedly, like Dan Aykroyd that says that some of the budget was used for that to keep the crew and cast up at night during the night shoots. And obviously, you know, John Belushi was the biggest lover of this part of the budget. This part of craft services.
Yes, well, as always, there will be spoilers ahead, so if you don't want this movie to be spoiled for you, then please hit pause, go watch it, and then come back and hear what we have to say.
Oh, I forgot to get your rap on the desk for luck, Frank. Let's kick it off here before our taglines.
Yes, I don't want the ghost of John Belushi to ruin our shoot.
Well, it was the ghost of Brandon Lee.
Right.
Last time,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, but you can never be safe.
Right. Outstanding.
On with the show.
The tagline that appears on the poster for this movie, well, I have five. The first is, they're back. That's it. The second is, the show that really hits the road.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah. The third is, a briefcase full of blues.
That was their first album, actually. Yeah. They opened for Steve Martin at the Universal Amphitheater, and that was the album.
Okay. Well, the fourth is, the most dangerous combination since nitro and glycerin. Colin really doesn't have much to say about any of these.
I mean, yeah, I'll wait, but...
Okay.
Continue.
Well, finally, bringing it home strong, they'll never get caught. They're on a mission from God.
Sure. That works. I mean, they only say, we're on a mission from God, and we're going to get the band back together no less than 100 times in the first half of the movie.
Well, right. It may not be the best description of this movie, so let's go to Colin and do a 60-second synopsis.
I think I actually might have a minute here. All right, time me. Okay. After receiving an early release from prison, Jake Blues reunites with his brother Elwood. When they discover that the orphanage that they were raised in is going to be shut down, the Blues brothers have a spiritual awakening, accept their mission from God, and decide to quote-unquote get the band back together to use their music to raise the $5,000 needed to save the orphanage. While traveling the country to round up their former bandmates, the brothers draw the ire of the police, neo-Nazis, a scorned woman, and a slighted country band. Eventually, the Blues Brothers perform a well-received show at the Palace Hotel in Chicago and are offered a $10,000 recording contract. With the money now in hand, the brothers, pursued by the collective might of their enemies, race to the bank to pay the tax bill and save the orphanage. There we go.
Nice. You came in about 15 seconds short on that one.
Well, it'll make up, I guess.
Those two-minute ones?
Yeah, for all the two- and three-minute ones.
Yeah, so, I mean, we heard Frank's origin story on the Blues Brothers. This is one that, for me, I'm aware of. I've seen it a few times back in the day. It's been many years since I've seen it. I've also seen the follow-up where Dan Aykroyd made sure to cast someone that was fatter than he was at the time so that he still looked like the skinny Blues Brother. But I don't have a whole lot of experience with this. And when I sat down to watch it, I didn't realize until after I had watched it and started doing like research on it that I had watched the extended edition. So, Colin, did you end up watching the one that was 2 hours and 15 minutes long or the one that was 2.5 hours long? And what is your experience with the Blues Brothers?
I watched the one that was 2.5 hours long, which was like 90 minutes longer than I wish this movie was.
Oh, no.
And I've never seen it before. And I have no reference point for it at all. I guess, like, my question about it is, like, I felt like I was missing something the whole time. So I feel like, is there, like, a background story to the Blues Brothers that I need to be aware of? Like, it's an SNL skit, is that right? But is it more than that?
They used to appear as musical guests, as, like, a comedy musical guest on the Saturday Night Live, but they did it straight, but they always had the bit where he came out with the briefcase handcuffed to his wrist to pull out his harmonica. Like, it was just, they would come out and do the occasional song back in the cocaine-fueled 70s of SNL.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it all started because Dan Aykroyd was very much into old-style blues and got John Belushi interested in it. And most of the musicians in the band were part of the SNL band.
Yeah, Paul Schaefer was the original keyboardist, and he was supposed to be in this movie, but had other obligations.
That's right. And a bunch of them knew other big musicians, like Steve Cropper and Donald Duck Dunn were part of the band Booker T and the MGs, a very popular band in the Stax label. And I guess connections from there. So they said, let's just form a band to do on the show. And yeah, it's kind of how it started. At least from what I've heard.
Yeah, my really only reference from the Blues Brothers is, for whatever reason, I remember the advertising for Blues Brothers 2000 being very prominent at the time that it came out.
Yeah.
I never watched that one either, but that's my only... I just remember seeing it and people being excited about it. And then I also remember hearing it sucked. So maybe that's why I had no interest in watching it or going back to see the original.
Yeah, I mean, this is the loosest skit that a Saturday Night Live movie has been based on. And this is, I mean, probably the first Saturday Night Live movie, I would say. You know, you have Coneheads and Wayne's World and It's Pat and The Ladies Man and on, Night at the Roxbury, Superstar. But this one, because it's just based on this band that comes out and sings the occasional song, it's like, the backstory, yeah, they're just inventing it. Like, I read that the original script for this was over 300 pages long, which at a minute a page is like a 300-minute movie.
5 hours.
Yeah. So, you know, it was trimmed down to 2.5, and then a little bit more to 215. But 2.5, yeah, is the extended edition. And it's the version I ended up watching, too. Hmm. Well, let's jump into the Blues Brothers. Inducted into the Library of Congress in 2020, it is directed by John Landis, who we've seen before on this show with Trading Places and Three Amigos. It's produced by Robert K. Weiss, who has a whole bunch of Weird Al stuff on his resume, but plus a bunch of like Scary Movie franchise and Naked Gun franchise. And then he did all those movies that I already mentioned, like Dragnet, Tommy Boy, Black Sheep, Night at the Roxbury, Superstar, The Ladies Man, all these ones with SNL people. That's his wheelhouse right there. Mm-hmm. And it's written by Dan Aykroyd and John Landis. And so we open the movie on first, like, shaky footage of just industrial Chicago. What a cesspool that was back in 1980. Holy shit.
It's also, I started watching this movie with my wife, and I was watching this scene, and I was like, I told her, it looks like somebody shot this on home video.
Yeah.
Like, it just looks...
Yeah, no permits, someone just, you know, rented a helicopter and flew over all these factories.
You know, I actually forgot about that image in the beginning, because it's been a while since I've seen the movie, and for a second I thought I clicked on the wrong film.
Yeah, it's like you're watching the beginning of Demolition Man or something.
Yeah.
But we cut to a prison, and they're raising the flag for the day, and a guard wakes up Jake to go see the warden. His cellmate was giving off some real Tupac energy to me, I have to say. But Jake is being released early for good behavior. And then as I'm watching the credits, I mean, like I said, it's been a long time since I've seen Blues Brothers. But the one that took me by surprise was seeing the choreographer credit. Because I'm just like, oh yeah, like Blues Brothers is kind of a musical.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
The scene, it happens right off the hop, but the scene that made me laugh the most was when, I don't even know what this job is called, but the person who gives the stuff back that he had in prison, when he's like, he's going through his stuff and he's like,
yeah,
one package,
Frank Oz,
one package prophylactic, and then it pauses and he's like, one soiled. I was like, why? You've just been hanging on to this thing for 3 years? What the
right?
hell?
Right, exactly. Yeah, I thought the same thing. I also really...
You would want that back?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a memento. But I also like the sight gag of him hiding behind, or having to stand behind the yellow line and everything.
Yeah.
You know, when he leans forward to sign the form and everything. But yeah, that's Frank Oz. Now, we saw Frank Oz in Trading Places also playing a cop at a jail. I'm wondering whether it's supposed to be the same character. I mean, that's 3 years later. Has he moved on to a different jail?
Yeah, I don't know. Or is Frank Oz just being typecast as a police officer?
Well, John Landis does like using him for cameos in movies. It's kind of like Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell. Also, Steven Spielberg is someone that he likes to slip into movies, too. And Steven Spielberg makes the appearance at the end as the clerk.
The county assessor. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, now that I remember, Frank Oz was also in Blues Brothers 2000, but he that time he was the warden of the prison.
Oh, okay.
Oh, he'd been promoted.
Yeah.
Nice. So, Elwood is out front to pick up Jake, and Elwood had to sell their old Cadillac to get a microphone. Now, this microphone comes up a few times in this movie. Why does it never make an appearance? I'm so disappointed that there's never a moment where you actually see this microphone that was worth their old car.
Well, if it's worth the price of a Cadillac, I'd probably say don't use it that much.
Yeah.
That's just my opinion. I don't know. But
I just think, you know, like, shouldn't that have been the microphone that they were using at the final concert?
Yeah, you would have thought there would have been, like, the whole, like, briefcase opening with the angels singing and the light shining out from the... And it's just this, like,
right?
Diamond-encrusted gold microphone.
Exactly. I mean, if it had been he traded the Cadillac for a harmonica and then he pulls the harmonica out, see, then I think that joke would have had a better payoff.
I mean, I'm going to guess that maybe this movie was filmed in sequence, and because it's like one of these SNL movies, I often get the feeling with these movies that they're kind of written as they go, this one especially. And so part of me just thinks, like, by the time they got to the end, they forgot that maybe that was a thing. You should write in to Dan Aykroyd and be like, "May you need to make a Blues Brothers 3 to pay off this joke from the original."
That's right. That's right.
You know, unless... with all the cocaine, that does sound like a possibility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, unless it was paid off in Blues Brothers 2000. I don't know. I mean... I
don't remember.
I think I've only seen that one once. But yeah, they have to go see the penguin because they promised. And so they go to the orphanage to see the nun. I laughed when I found out that the nun is named Sister Mary Stigmata. But I have to say that the very top of the stairs at a really weird angle is a super creepy place to keep your Christ statue.
Yeah. Yeah. I did. That was one of those things. I did see that. And then I kind of just was like, that's interesting. And then I just like passed out of my reference. But you are right. I think it's kind of like, or maybe it's at the top. Is that at the top of the church? Like, is that like kind of opening out down to like the, I don't even, what do you call it? Like the sanctuary part where everybody sits?
I don't, well, it seemed like such a narrow staircase. It kind of felt like it was just this back staircase straight up to her office.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you gotta fit the Jesus in wherever you can.
Yeah. Right.
There's always room for the Lord.
Exactly. Oh,
yes. Yes.
But we find out that the county wants $5,000 or the orphanage is going to close. I like all the sight gags with them having to sit in the little desks. Mm-hmm. But I read that John Belushi actually injured his back doing the stunt, like, with the desk, like, falling over in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he was wearing a back brace for the rest of the shoot.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. You know, I hate to say this, but ever since seeing that when I was a freshman in high school, I'd always wanted to try that. Yeah. I know it probably won't end well, but...
Oh, probably not. No, no. So they realize that they have to get this money in a straight way. They can't go and just steal this money. They have to find an honest way to get this money. And then they go to the Triple Rock Baptist Church, where James Brown is the preacher, one of many, many, many cameos in this movie. Like, I didn't even realize half the cameos that I was supposed to see in this movie. Like, I was watching this with my girlfriend at the time, and I know I made some joke about Aretha Franklin. And my girlfriend's like, "Oh, wait, that's Aretha Franklin?" And I'm like, "Yeah, right? Like, even her, like, you don't even recognize her." But, like, there's so many others that, because I was 2 years old in 1980, I have no idea who these other people are.
Yeah, I didn't recognize, like, that. That was kind of one of the things that took me out of the movie a little bit was, like, I imagine part of the reason why this movie was so huge at the time it came out was because all the cameos would have been really relevant, whereas I find watching it now, yeah, I had no reference point. Like, I vaguely knew, like, I know Aretha Franklin and James Brown and Ray Charles, like, basically by name, but I've never actually sat down and listened to I don't think any of their music.
Yeah.
It was just, and then I think the thing is, like, the scenes are so long because they clearly want to give these people their due and let them sing like a full song and stuff. But I just kind of sat through the whole movie and be like, okay, like, let's move it along, boys. Like, let's go.
So basically, it's like, if you don't like soul music and car chases, you know, this movie isn't for you.
Basically.
When you put it that way.
Yeah. Okay, so when they get to that church, though, I mean, first of all, I don't know why, if they're Catholic, they're going to a Baptist church, or is it just the closest one? Or was this just so we could get some diversity into the movie, which I'm not complaining about? This is probably one of the most diverse movies that we've actually watched on our show from 1980. I was impressed. But why don't they ever sit down when they go into the church? Why do they stand at the back creeping the whole time?
Yeah, I don't know.
Were all the seats filled?
I don't know. So. Yeah.
It did seem pretty packed, and it was kind of bumping.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they were just waiting for things to settle.
Yeah. But this is where Jake ends up handspringing down the aisle, like we mentioned earlier. He can't fight the Holy Spirit. He sees the light. And my God, like, I just, that must have been, like, such a tiring, sweaty day of filming, doing all of this stuff, like, all the dancing and everything. That and, like, the final concert. Like, those two is just like, oh, you'd be exhausted after that day of filming.
Yeah. You can even see the sweat in the last scene when I'm talking to the record guy.
Yeah.
You can just see it dripping right off their faces.
Yeah, yeah.
And who knows how many takes it took.
Exactly. But then we get our first of the, we gotta put the band together drops, because that's the light that Jake has seen. That's how they're gonna get the money for the orphanage. While they're planning to put the band back together, they get pulled over for running a yellow light. And, well, we get a car chase through a mall.
Oh my gosh. These car chases, man, like...
And I get it's a comedy movie in the 1980s. It's not supposed to make sense. But the whole time I was watching, I was like... I mean, in Edmonton, I guess. Like, in Edmonton, I know our police have, like, a no-chase rule.
Yeah.
So it's like, car chases aren't even really a thing. But it's like, the idea that the police would essentially cause as much damage as the people they're chasing and endanger, like, just innocent citizens and all this driving through a mall is wild. I didn't mind the car chases, though. I thought those would have been the highlight of the movie for me.
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely something satisfying about seeing a car plow through a Toys R Us.
Yeah. I think they're just so next level.
Yeah.
It's like shades of the Fast and the Furious. Where you're just like, how insane and ridiculous can this be?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Like the car that ends up flying off the overpass at the end. Yeah.
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 But, I mean, I did mention Toys R Us, so I think it's time for Sponsorship Corner. So, always on the lookout for product placements in movies. Holy shit. This week, Blues Brothers is brought to you by Miller Lite, Busch, Michelob, Dewey's, Blatz, Budweiser, Huber, Old Style, Stroh's, Olympia, and Natural Light Beer, Jack Daniels, Night Train Express Wine, Fresca, Orange Crush, Coca-Cola, and Pepsi-Cola, Trailways and Greyhound Bus Lines, Kellogg's, Wrigley's Gum, Lifesavers, Jewel Supermarket, Toys R Us, JCPenney, Cat Diesel Power, Chicago Cubs and Cincinnati Reds, Ford and Dodge, kind of Dodge. Like, they drive a Dodge, but the middle D is missing, but the cops refer to it as a Dodge. Mm-hmm. So, it's a Dodge.
It's a Doge coin.
Yeah. Holiday Inn, Palace, and Plymouth Hotel. The Plymouth Hotel was real, which is the one that says, "For men and transients welcome." I love that sign. The Vaseline, Marlboro cigarettes, Fender guitars, Outdoor Man canopies, Sesame Street and Mickey Mouse, Pier 1 imports, Howard Johnson's, Visa and MasterCard, Sony and JBL electronics, Atlantic Records, Valvoline oil, Shell and Argon gas. Now, Argon, I don't know if it's real. Frank, you're American. When I Google it, the top results are for, like, literal argon gas. Like, off the periodic table, argon gas. Is this a gas chain you're aware of called Argon?
I've never heard of argon gas, so it must be that.
Like, unless it is Midwest, because I know you're West Coast, so...
Possibly.
Yeah, okay.
I have no idea.
And Timex, sort of, because it's name-dropped in the beginning and the watch gets held up. And they kind of make a nod to the slogan of takes a licking and keeps on ticking because his watch is broken. Another running joke that happens in this movie, the broken watches.
Right.
Okay, now, I'm not done yet. Here's where sponsorship corner gets super confusing for me. Or like, maybe I'm just too lazy to research everything else. But the Blues Brothers really seems to thrive on highlighting Illinois and especially the city of Chicago. So the majority of these other placements in the movie are probably real, at least at, like, some point in time. But some of them, like Curl Up and Die Beauty Salon, are probably fictional. Or the fact that Soul Food Cafe was filmed in Nate's Delicatessen, but in some of the street scenes you still see the sign for Nate's. So here's the rest that I saw in no particular order. Nelson Funeral Home, Lemmy's Sausage, Davidson's Bakery, Margie's Bridal, Genghis Formal Wear, Burt's Shoes, Rose's Discount Records, Hal's Cigarettes, 18 Pawn Shop, Dill Pickle Delicatessen, Vienna Pure Beef Polish Sausage, Ray's Music Exchange, Bob's Country Bunker, Lowe's Brothers Warehouse, Lloyd's Tire Clinic, the West Wind Motel, and the fictional movie See You Next Wednesday, because John Landis has that in every one of his movies. And this has been Sponsorship Corner.
I didn't know that.
I've brought that up every time we've had a John Landis movie.
Clearly, I just tune out.
Oh yeah. it was a poster in Jamie Lee Curtis's apartment in Trading Places.
Oh right, I do remember you saying this now.
Yeah.
Is it the same post? No, it's not the same poster every time.
No, it's just a different movie.
Reference is made.
Yeah. So they managed to get away from the cops, and they also managed to get away from a rocket launcher that Carrie Fisher has.
So the version that you're telling me, the version that I watched, the 2.5 hour one, is an extended version?
Yeah.
What is the added substance in the extended version? Do you know?
I read some of it, and now I can't remember. Like I'll probably remember when I get to those points in my notes, but
okay,
yeah.
The only reason I asked was I found the Carrie Fisher stuff very, like, just so strange. Like,
yeah,
it just shows up, and I'm like, how do you miss so terribly with the rocket launcher? And then I also couldn't tell, is in that scene, it shows the rocket being shot about 4 or 5 times,
yeah.
And I couldn't tell if she shot 4 times or if it was just. If they were just trying to show it from, like, varying angles.
The
like
action movie cliche?
Do.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, I'm not sure. I thought it was 4 rockets as well because, like, she absolutely demolishes the hotel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I guess I jumped slightly ahead. I do have to say I also like Elwood's room that he has where the train goes by. You know, how often does the train go by? So often that you'll stop noticing it.
Mm. Yeah.
And the added touch of the jar of Vaseline on the nightstand was also a good one.
Yeah.
But, and John Candy shows up, and that's when Carrie Fisher blows up the building, and my girlfriend at that point says, well, that's excessive. And what about everyone else in the building?
Right.
Yeah. Like, the Blues Brothers got away.
Him.
Yeah, yeah. The cops get away, but everyone else is dead, as far as I know.
Yeah, it's kind of bad, because I like the Cheese Whiz guy. They're giving me my Cheese Whiz, boy!
Oh, okay. Here's one of the scenes that I know is in the extended edition is when we see Elwood at work.
Right.
When he goes to quit. This is a scene that wasn't in the original edition.
Right.
I like the sight gag of him taking the two cans off the assembly line. Like, he just likes stealing, which is funny. But I like how it screws up the rest of the assembly line. So if you didn't watch the extended edition, you have no idea what I'm talking about, but at least we all seem to know the extended edition. So
yeah, I actually, for this viewing, I did watch the regular version because I was on Peacock. And for once, I was able to watch a movie for this program that I didn't have to pay extra for.
Oh,
so yay. But but thanks to YouTube, I've seen the scenes that were cut and put in the extended edition. I think I saw a YouTube playlist, and it was one after another, just the scenes that were cut.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's how I got to know those ones, like the scene in the factory and a few others.
So, I'm not sure. When they go to find their first buddy at Chez Pierre, or Chez whatever it was. Chez Paul.
Chez Pierre is a strip club in Edmonton.
Oh, yeah.
This is Sean's little slip up. We know what he does in his springtime now.
Yeah. Wow.
So, but
sounds like a Canadian strip club to me, honestly.
Yeah, a little bit. They'll show you their
poutines.
Their chest. Their chest shields. Their mucklocks and bunny hugs. Yeah. So, but okay,
that's
so.
A good one.
At Chez Paul, I don't quite understand why them looking into the dining room causes everyone to stop eating and look. Like, they're not dressed shockingly for this restaurant. Like, the only thing unusual about them is they've got sunglasses on, you know? They're in suits.
Well, but they're also dressed identically. Maybe I think there's something to that, but... The Blues Brothers, to me, in this movie, have, like, an unearned sense of, like, grandeur that just seems to captivate everybody around them, but it's never really explained why they're so revered.
Well, I think I discovered that in the scene later on where we find out, finally, what Carrie Fisher's connection to them is, and that's because you never see them without their sunglasses until mm-hmm. that moment, and it's like, oh, that's where the power is. It's in the eyes.
Yeah.
It's like mm-hmm. it's like a Medusa with a love beam is what John Belushi is like once he pulls those Ray-Bans down, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So they manage to recruit their first band member, though, and they're heading out to recruit more, and they get stuck in a traffic jam because there's neo-Nazis that won some sort of settlement in court. Do neo-Nazis wear full Nazi regalia like this? I don't think they do they?
Not to my knowledge.
When I think of neo-Nazis, I always think of, like, skinheads.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly.
Or like American History X or something like that.
Yeah. So I don't feel like they would be wearing, like, full Third Reich Heil Hitler garb, you know?
Mm-hmm. I actually heard that little bit was based off an actual court case around that time involving some small Nazi faction.
Yeah.
In the state of Illinois, something about free speech or something. I don't really remember. I learned about it in college, and
okay.
I instantly thought of the Blues Brothers when she said that. And my professor's like, if you saw the Blues Brothers, you know. I was like, ah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. The more you know. Apparently, the original script, though, had, like, another storyline of the Nazis trying to buy the orphanage to use as a new headquarters.
Oh,
I would have liked that. That would have been a nice added.
Right?
I kind of felt like that was the missing link to this story, was that they needed to be trying to, like, beat more than just, like, the tax collectors to the... It's kind of like, you know, in Happy Gilmore when Grandma's about to lose her house and then Shooter...
Yeah.
Like, the story really picks up when you find out Shooter's going to buy the house.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
True.
Yeah.
Like, it's their take on, like, a Smokey and the Bandit type movie is kind of what they've got going on here. And, yeah, you're right. Some of the threads aren't quite connected. But I will say that I enjoyed this far more than I did with Trading Places. If we're going to just compare John Landis movies for a moment. You know, Colin, you don't seem too on board with this one. But I actually, there was a lot that I ended up liking about this. on the revisit. There was some stuff I didn't, but but yeah, they drive some Nazis off the bridge, and then we get an Aretha Franklin musical number, because why not? If you've got Aretha Franklin, you might as well get her to fucking sing a song. But the short-hearted cook coming out, the guy that, like, lets down his grizzled mane out of his hairnet, and he's up on the counter playing the saxophone, it's like, that's what, he's one sketchy-looking dude. You know, like...
yeah.
But, you know, like, what did we learn today? If you're gonna try to play the man-woman card, make sure your wife isn't Aretha Franklin. Otherwise, you might get a song out of it. You know?
To that, I don't know who the actor, who that black guy, I don't know what his name is.
And Matt, I don't know.
Matt he's another Murphy.
Okay, yeah. He's another cameo.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He was a musician in the Blues Brothers thing.
I felt like he was having trouble with that scene and just like trying to be like assertive with Aretha Franklin, who I feel like is beyond like,
oh yeah,
like she's unfuckwithable. Like
you no way, yeah, absolutely. Like, she's got like, songs about
like,
that shit.
You can't talk to me like that, woman. Like, you could tell like he was afraid for someone.
Yeah, he
like,
as a
my
person
mama's gonna
was
slap
intimate.
Me if I say this.
Yeah, I can't talk to Aretha Franklin like that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did read, during that scene, that particular recording was of the song Think was recorded beforehand, and she had to lip sync it through. Mm-hmm. And Aretha's not used to that, apparently, so she had a lot of trouble. But she got it eventually.
Yeah, see, I think ultimately she was pretty good. I thought Cab Calloway was pretty good as well.
Oh, yeah.
As I forget what his little sidekick character's name is. Curtis.
Curtis.
Cab Calloway is Curtis, yeah. Say that 10 times fast. That's how I warm up before before podcast. Cab Calloway is Curtis. So they end up going to Ray's Pawn Shop, and so we now get our Ray Charles cameo. We've already had our John Lee Hooker and our Aretha Franklin, and yeah, we get to see Ray Charles now, and he sings a song because Ray Charles, and everyone outside the shop starts dancing. But I was going through like my IMDb trivia for this movie, and in the trivia someone wrote Ray Charles has never seen this movie.
Oh really?
Yeah.
And I don't know whether they were trying to be funny or whether they like literally meant like, no, he has never attended a screening of this movie. Like, I don't know which way that leans, but either way, guy on IMDb, you got a thumbs up from me today when I was scrolling through IMDb, because that was hilarious to me. But I thought Ray Charles was a lot of fun. I liked later when they're hanging up the posters for the things where we flash for their concert, where we flash back to Ray Charles and he's hung his poster upside down. I appreciate that they had fun with him, or that he allowed them to have fun at his expense.
Mm-hmm.
Ray Charles is cool shit.
Yeah.
As far as the cameos go, I'm embarrassed to admit it took me a while to, I was like, who is that guy? And then I was like, Stevie One.
Oh
no! And then I was like, oh no, it's Ray Charles. And then I was like, Jamie Foxx.
No, just kidding.
Oh dear.
I also like the bit where Elwood is over trying to use the toaster in the pawn shop.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they managed to get instruments from Ray Charles on credit for their upcoming show as they put the rest of their band together. And then, like, Jake wants to phone their booker, but Carrie Fisher shows up with a flamethrower and the conveniently placed giant propane tank next to their phone booth. But they still manage to escape because she is terrible, because later on when she has the gun, she can't fucking hit anything either. Having both movies in theaters at the same time, she was obviously getting shooting lessons from the stormtroopers over on the set of Empire. Did I miss them getting the rest of their band back?
Yeah, Mr. Fabulous, the Holiday Inn.
That's right.
Murph and the Magic Tones.
Murph and the Magic Tones. Boy, that gig would suck. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
One thing I don't like, though, is, like, you look at the Blues Brothers, they're in matching suits. You look at Murph and the Magic Tones, they're all in matching suits. But when the Blues Brothers band ends up getting put together, they don't have any kind of cohesive look except for the two frontmen.
Yeah.
And the Cab Calloway song where they all magically change into tuxedos. But, like, it's kind of disappointing that there's no, like, common thread with the band.
You know, now that you put it that way, I'm bothered by that, too.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear you say that wasn't... I thought that I had, like, looked at my phone at the wrong part or at the wrong time and like, just looked back up and everybody was dressed in formal wear.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that makes sense now.
Well, because, I mean, it's Cab Calloway singing his signature song, and he right. has to wear his signature outfit for singing that signature song. There's a lot of signatures up in the air here. He's juggling a lot of balls. So, I mean, he can't be performing that song in a Blues Brothers okay. outfit. Yeah.
Yeah, see, again, that's, like, something that's just completely lost. Like I have no idea who Cab Calloway is.
Well, see, some of this is me in the 80s watching the Jerry Lewis telethons. Mm. Because Cab Calloway was one of the guys that would show up to that. That's also...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's also why I know someone like Sammy Davis Jr. And I think Ray Charles was one of the guys that was... So, like, I would see variety shows with these guys, and that's why I know that, yeah, Cab Calloway would come out in the white tuxedos. Yeah, growing up, my parents were also a big watcher of, like, Smothers Brothers, too. So, like, these kinds of guys showed up on shows like that, you know?
Yeah, okay.
But now that they've got the whole band together... They tricked the band into thinking that they actually have a performance at the, it's basically Roadhouse. They've got the chicken wire rap stage where they like all kinds of music, country and Western.
I've always loved that joke. And she just says it with so much enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Both kinds.
But what I don't understand about... the chicken wire rap stage, because I mean, this means it's a tough bar. I mean, we know that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised, one, that the blues isn't cutting it for these people. You'd think that would be close enough to country and Western. I feel like they're kind of in the same family.
In a way.
Well, is blues the same as bluegrass? Like, I guess I feel like blues.
Not entirely.
I feel like blues to me, in my mind, is closer to like. This is going to sound like it's closer to like jazz and like,
yeah,
brass, like, which is more sophisticated than what I think of when I think of the country bumpkins.
Yeah, I just like, think if it's the kind of place that says country and Western, mm-hmm. you know, all of a sudden I kind of think that, well, maybe they're not listening to the most advanced country, or, you know, country music. Like, we're talking more like Conway Twitty type stuff.
Yeah, I guess.
Which
yeah,
all kind
I guess,
of
like,
shares the DNA with the old blues and jazz and everything, you know?
Yeah, like, I'd say Willie Nelson is close to blues, so.
Yeah, they sing Stand By Your Man, and everyone is excited about that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's Patsy Cline. Like, that's like 50s, 60s country. So. Mm. And the yeah. Rawhide theme.
There's also an attitude to country and Western music. So, like, maybe it's the fact that they have, you know, black people in their band and they're dressed in suits that might be the problem. Maybe they're expecting, like,
more belt buckles.
Cowboy hats and belt buckles and
bolo ties. Yeah.
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 Well, you know, now that I think about it, I think the reason why the song that they played in the first place, Give Me Some Love, and isn't really considered much of a old school blues song, you know. Yeah. It's kind of more of a soul. I think they call it Blue Eyed Soul because it was a white group, but okay. Yeah, something like that. I don't know.
Yeah. Once they start getting happy about them singing the Rawhide theme, and this was another one of those extended moments, by the way, is the second verse of Rawhide that you get, that wasn't in the original cut, so there you go, Colin, there's another one of those. But how come they're still throwing bottles at the fucking stage when they're in a good mood, too?
Guess that's just how it is, I guess.
I hate working at this bar.
Why do you think they have the fence?
Well, that's why they have the fence, but I mean, fuck. Like, when you're in a good mood, too, you're trashing shit. Like, I guess this is, like, mob mentality. I mean, that's what happens, you know, that's why we end up having, like, sports riots when teams win playoffs, but, like, seriously. Stop throwing the bottles. You're getting what you want. They're singing Patsy Cline.
Maybe it's kind of like, you know, when people say the word fuck. And sometimes you can say it, and you're pissed off, and it's in you're angry. You know, it covers a wide variety of things. And sometimes you can say it when you're, like, ecstatic and excited and happy.
Fuck yeah!
And so maybe that's these people's scenario, where they're just like, the chicken wire is there. So it's, you know, it's just it can take all emotions. If we're happy, we'll throw stuff out of glee. If we're mad, we'll throw stuff out of rage. It's really all about the intent. Like,
if you're happy, throw your beer.
Yeah, the bottle really carries the intent of the person throwing it. Yeah. So,
well, I
can't presume to look into the heart of these people.
Yeah, I remember when I was at Woodstock '99. Oh, I forget which band it was that wanted. I think it was DMX that wanted us to all start throwing our bottles in the air. Like, it was like, yeah, because we all had plastic water bottles and it looked cool. But then you would get some bottles where people hadn't drinking all the water and you'd get hit in the back with them. You know, like, it's, I don't know, but it was a joyful moment that we're throwing those bottles.
Or you'd get hit in the back with a bottle that was filled with piss because there was no washrooms. And I've seen the documentaries.
I've read about that, too. You were at Woodstock 99.
I was at Woodstock 99, yeah.
That is crazy.
It's really the thing that makes Sean the coolest in my eyes.
What can I say? What can I say? It's been all downhill since 1999. I'm sitting there watching the scene of them singing. Because I'm unfamiliar with the movie because it's been so long, I'm sitting there going, aren't the good old boys going to show up at some point? Like, how come that never comes up? And then it's like when they're leaving after Last Call, and I have to assume they've been singing Rawhide and Patsy Cline back and forth all night. But yeah, how come they show up after Last Call and they're just like, oh, we're late? It's like, well, yeah, you're like 5 hours late.
I never understood.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a bit too far-fetched of a we're late situation.
Yeah.
It feels like the good old boys should have shown up in the middle of the set. But then we couldn't have this whole moment of them owing $300 for beer on a gig that they were only getting paid $200 for.
Yeah.
So
it's a ripoff.
I also like the line where they say that Stand By Your Man is a favorite of the horn section because there's no horns that get played in that song. I thought that was a fun, subtle joke.
It's nice.
But so now we get more of a car chase and the weirdest looking double car flip that I've ever seen in a movie, because we get the cops that are hiding behind the billboard for See You Next Wednesday and they start chasing and then they end up T-boning Bob's truck and somehow they both flip sideways at the exact same time before any contact is actually made with the T-bone. Mm-hmm. It was a weird stunt. They really just liked wrecking cars in this movie.
I didn't get... They seemed to, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed to me like that's, like, on the side of a hill somewhere, no? But when the truck falls down, it looks like they've hit a fire hydrant or something. Like, there's water. Water comes spraying out for some weird reason.
Yeah, I don't know.
I didn't get it. But I also just wanted to say that it's like, you know, we're in the age where we're always talking about, you know, how the police handle their business and police brutality and all this stuff. The police in this movie are out of hand. Like in what world do you just, you're like, oh, we need to take this person down. So before we even give them a chance to pull over, we'll just smash into the side of their vehicle.
Yeah.
And go flying down an embankment.
Yeah, it's a little excessive.
But that's what makes it fun.
Yeah. So we end up getting our steam room scene where they try to get themselves booked into a hall that seats 5,000 people because they'll get $5,000 easily. So does that mean they're charging $1 per ticket?
Yeah, if you do the math, probably.
I like the gag reveal of the rest of the band being in the steam room behind them while they're having this conversation. Yeah. I thought that was a good reveal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we start getting our advertising where the flyers are being put out, and the Blues Brothers are driving around in their car on the beach everywhere with a giant megaphone. This isn't the microphone that he bought, right? Like, where did they get this? Like, if they're trying to raise $5,000, did they steal this? Because then they're stealing in their mission from God. And so now it's like, you tainted the whole reason for trying to get about all this money, honestly.
Well, thanks for ruining the movie. I'm kidding. You know, when you put it that way, maybe it was the microphone he got. I don't know.
Yeah.
I never thought of it that way.
And so they are finally on their way to their concert, and they scam the one. This is the supermodel Twiggy. I didn't realize that until I saw the credits. I only know of her by name. I know she is a supermodel. I don't know if she's actually British or whether she's Australian, but yeah, that's Twiggy. And Elwood scams her out of some gas money after stealing some things out of the gas station that they're in, because the gas station is out of gas.
Right.
But it looks like he steals wiper blades. But later in the movie, there's the whole bit where there's a car chase and the radiator is spraying oil up onto the windshield, and they only have one wiper. So if you stole wiper blades, why didn't you put them on the car? You were hanging out at this gas station all that time.
There's too many. It's like this movie, as we're going through it, it's like this movie purposely is trying to create logical inconsistencies.
Yeah, right? Like, just tie some of this together.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised as if that was the intent.
Yeah. Well, like, because the cans that he steals off of the assembly line in the deleted scene, I feel like that's what he sprays on the Winnebago's gas pedal. That was my impression from that scene. So that one came back, but like nothing else that he has stolen throughout the movie has come back. Like, it's just, yeah. Too much cocaine on set, I don't know.
Sean's getting itchy. they're just lucky the internet didn't exist.
That's
when
right.
When this movie came out, otherwise you were like, in the scene where then it would just got lit up on Twitter.
Worst continuity ever.
Yeah.
So the concert has started. Cab Calloway he's delaying the inevitable because they haven't arrived because they're stuck at a gas station. He sings his song. Then the Blues Brothers manage to show up, and they sneak in the back door because there's a whole bunch of people at this concert looking for them. There's the good old boys. There's, like, I don't know, I guess every cop in Illinois. John Candy ordering orange whips.
I have a question, because I didn't really understand. I still don't really understand. So this is based off the Blues Brothers are a band.
Yes.
And I guess they were a band before Jake went away to jail.
Yes.
But are they like a known band? Like, are they well known? Because it doesn't seem, they don't have a record deal or anything at this point, it doesn't seem like.
Yeah.
They're just trying to get the band back together. I just don't understand, like, what did people want to come see them, or was it just kind of like they just booked the gig?
Yeah, like, because something I don't understand is the fact that everyone is just absolutely losing their shit over Minnie the Moocher, and he's not actually Cab Calloway. He's not supposed to be, I don't think. But then when they get on stage, dead silence. So it's like, who the fuck did you think you were there to see?
Yeah.
And wouldn't you be, like, wanting your money back after they literally play a couple songs and then leave?
Right. Yeah. So was it $1 a ticket? Like, I mean, fuck, it's just not worth it. Yeah, you're right. Like, two songs and they just dip out of there. I don't know. But, I mean, they managed to get the crowd warmed up to them eventually, though.
Right.
But, like, I gotta say, though, it looks like they are having so much fun when they're singing.
Yeah. Like,
there is something very infectious about them singing and dancing on that stage, though, that just, it looks like fun.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah. So, they end up sneaking out the back door, like Colin said. They've been offered a record deal, so they've managed to be able to pay the band and pay the orphanage, and they sneak out of there, and then we get like an hour worth of car chase with all those cop cars crashing down the embankment. We see that Twiggy has been stood up by Elwood. Oh, poor Twiggy. But there is this moment, though, in the car chase, though, where, like, the music fades out, and then it fades back in, like, almost like the movie was going to a commercial break. Like, what's going on there? Did they have an intermission when this movie originally came out or something?
I don't know.
They should have. I mean, I had to watch... At this point of the movie, I'm not gonna lie, I had to watch it at 1.5... the, like, speed, because I was just like, we need to march to the end here.
Yeah. I love, though, when they're, because they're trying to get their money to the city assessor's office, and, you know, they're flying down the streets of Chicago. Where is everybody? There's, like, no other cars on the streets of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've seen these same tunnels used in The Dark Knight, even though that's supposed to be Gotham, whatever. But it's, like, the same tunnels, and they litter those with other cars and other people. I read that they had to get, like, a special permission from the city of Chicago to be able to drive the Blues Brothers car down this one stretch under the elevated train at 118 miles an hour. They are actually going that fast. And they got permission to do it. They were allowed to do two passes. They did one with nobody on the street, and they did one with, like, stunt pedestrians on the street, but no other cars. Why aren't there any cars in the other lane, at least, going the other direction?
Yeah. Hmm. Oh, that's almost worth a rewatch. I didn't even really notice.
Yeah. I mean, I do like that there is the part of the chase where the Winnebago, where he gets his foot glued to the gas pedal, and luckily all the cop cars on the highway are spaced out enough for a Winnebago to weave in and out of them. It's like, that's some pretty convenient spacing. Or are cops trained to actually space themselves apart far enough to make sure that if one of them wipes out, they don't all go down the embankment, even though this movie would lead me to believe that they do?
Probably.
Like, I mean, they don't like to explode a lot of cop cars, but they definitely like to flip cars. You know, I wish I had kept a tally. I read that there were 103 wrecked cars in this, but I want to know how many of those were just flipped cars.
Let's see, carry to one. No, okay.
Another scene I felt like I averted my eyes and missed something was at what point there's just like a cop car that's seemingly falling in the middle of the city.
No, that's the Nazis.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they okay. End up there's the part where the Blues Brothers almost drive off the end of the unfinished overpass. Right. And then they manage to back up, and then they manage to backflip their car over the Nazis' car. And the Nazis go flying off this overpass, and then the next shot is them falling from, like, a height as tall as the Sears Tower.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And this is an actual car falling. They had to receive an air UN worthiness certificate from the FAA in order to drop this car in Chicago from this height.
Wow. I would have paid good money to see that live shot.
Yeah
Just make sure you're out of the way.
Maybe that explains why the streets were empty. I feel like I wouldn't want to risk like any people being in probably like a 5-kilometer radius around there.
Yeah.
Just in case, I don't know, the wind caught the car or something. Like,
yeah for sure. Yeah, because it is kind of the Windy City, isn't it? Famously. Oh, yeah. The Windy.
Yes.
City.
Yes, that is true.
It's also the second city.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
That's right.
I only know that from CM Punk, which Frank will get that. Frank will know who that is.
Oh, yeah. So they make it to this office of the city assessor, and for some reason, like, they've got the National Guard out. They've got fire trucks out to break the door down. I do like the bit with them stacking everything in front of the door and, and, you know, asking the guy the directions to the city assessor's office, and they don't realize anything is happening. Like, that is a funny moment when all of a sudden the floodgates open. I don't understand, though, that once the fire guys chop open the doors, why the firefighters are the first guys through the door. Like, it should be, okay, here's your hole. See you later, cops. Mm-hmm. Like, our job is done. They're invested in this chase at this point. The firefighters want a piece.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like when you have what, seemingly 1,000 people after the, like, mob mentality is bound to kick in where you're just like, we're a part of this now. Chop yeah. off their heads.
Yeah. Insurrection at the Capitol. Oh, too soon.
Oh, shit.
Too soon. Ah, Jesus Christ. Shit.
You just had to, didn't you?
Go listen to Frank's episode called Insurrection Junction on Frank.
Well, come on. We have our own. Come on. Yeah, we have our Parliament. Yeah, convoy to Parliament. Let's go.
Trucker Convoy 2021. Oh, boy.
Wait, you guys had something like that happen up there?
Oh, we started it. If you guys had one, it was because we did it first.
Not an interaction, but it was like
there was a trucker's convoy that literally shut down Ottawa for
3 weeks?
Almost 3 weeks, a month, yeah.
Yeah,
that I heard about. Was it really a month?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they gridlocked downtown Ottawa.
Wow.
Yeah, and they blocked the border crossing for almost 2 weeks before they finally removed them. Yeah. Mm. Fucking ridiculous. Anyway, I also wonder why it takes so long for Jake and Elwood to get up 11 floors. Because the city assessor's office is on the 11th floor, and it keeps cutting back to them in the elevator as all this stuff is happening in the lobby.
The 1980s, I mean, the elevators weren't what they are now.
Well, yeah, because apparently it is very easy to short out so that everyone else has to use the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
But they managed to pay off the debt for the orphanage just in time to get cuffs slapped on them. But Steven Spielberg, he stamps the hell out of that receipt for them. And then we get, like, kind of the finale of them being in jail playing Jailhouse Rock. Why is the rest of the band in jail, though? Like, was it for aiding and abetting their escape, maybe? Yeah. Like,
Accessories?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And I'm disappointed that we never got to see the microphone. It should have been... maybe it should have been in jail. I don't know.
That should have been the last shot. Should have just opened with this microphone being lowered to the stage.
The light on it.
Yeah. And in the credits, we get a credit for woman on cutting room floor, Shirley Levine, who I heard is John Landis's mother. I don't know whether she actually filmed the scene and they cut it out, but he gave her the credit anyway, or whether it's just an inside joke. Because the very end of the movie, after the credits, we get a John Landis running joke from Animal House, which is, when you're in Hollywood, visit Universal Studios and ask for Babs. Because I guess for a while in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, if you went to Universal Studios and asked for Babs, who was a character from Animal House, that her ending story is that she goes off to Universal Studios. I guess if you asked for Babs at the front gate, they would actually give you free admission to Universal Studios.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, I actually remember that was in the credits for Blues Brothers 2000, too.
Oh, was it?
Okay. Yeah, ask for Babs. Thing.
Yeah, I've heard they don't honor it anymore. But
I can see why.
Yeah, especially, you know, because internet. But there we go. That is the Blues Brothers. Now, Colin, Frank, on IMDb, it scored a 7.9 out of 10 and has a Metascore of 60. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 73% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 92%. But Colin, those are just numbers. like 103 wrecked cars, setting a Guinness World Record at the time, until it was passed by another movie 2 years later, and eventually The Matrix Reloaded, because the new Guinness record is there's 300 wrecked cars. Hit us with some reviews! That was the longest one ever.
All right. Rotten Tomatoes super reviewer Stephen E. gives the movie 2.5 out of 5 stars and says, I applaud the Blues Brothers for its attempts at being as epic as it is and for having such a long running time for a comedy, but for all the talent involved, it's a disappointment. It's apparent that time has taken a toll on both the film's charm and humor, which have all but evaporated, and Jake and Elwood Blues come off as manipulative, destructive jerks. Of course, I guess that The Blues Brothers was intended to be over the top, and the amount of mayhem in the chaotic finale is kind of hilarious, but the film, just frankly, isn't good. Isn't very good, sorry.
Frankly, I don't know. I just wanted to say that part.
we'll allow Frank is the only one who can throw around Franklies here. Jim H. gives the movie 5 out of 5 stars and says, 40 years in and this hilarious musical farce remains as fresh as the first time I saw it. It has its quote-unquote haters, I'm sure, but that's because its humor skewers the pretentious and the politically correct at every turn. Set those affectations aside and there are multiple layers on which to enjoy this movie. Who knew actors could sing? Who knew blues musicians could act? Who knew they could all dance so well? Marvel at the comedic timing and instincts of John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd at the absolute top of their game. Glory in the great R&B numbers delivered by the industry legends who made these hits. Reflect on some of the subtle social commentary layered in beneath the farce. Most of all, if you can't tap your toes to this one, you better check for a pulse.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. PA says 5 out of 5 stars. It's too long. There's too many scenes which add no value, but the music is magical. The main characters are spot on, and ultimately this is a fabulous feel-good film which never fails to make you feel positive.
Okay.
And then last one, Kyle C. gives the movie 4 out of 5 stars and says, it took me a few minutes to sink into the vibe that this film was going for, but once I had the right mindset, this was a blast. The music is phenomenal and the guest stars keep every scene feeling unique. Aykroyd and Belushi's completely straight performances bring out the surreality of the story. Ever escalating into absurdity, The Blues Brothers is a cult classic for anyone.
Right on. So, yeah, like I said, 7.9 and 92 from audiences. 60 and 73 from critics. Now, I will say that, yes, there were things that I liked about this movie. There were things that I didn't like about this movie. Colin and I have seen Dan Aykroyd enough on this show for me to be able to say, I think this is my favorite Dan Aykroyd performance that we've seen. A movie is always elevated by John Candy. I wish I had seen more John Candy. I wish he had been more of a consistent on their trail detective. Like, that's what I felt was missing, is a lot of the connective tissue between the side characters. Like, the Carrie Fisher stuff was unnecessary, but if it had somehow connected with something else that was going on, like, that she was someone that was there by hire instead of someone that just had her heart broken, right? Like, if she was the assassin that the Nazis had hired to bring them down, like, you know, something like that would have made more sense. But I love the music. I appreciated it more than the last time I saw it, because I was probably too young to fully understand everything that was going on the last time I saw it. I was probably like 16 or something the last time I saw this movie. So, you know, I appreciated the hell out of a lot of it. But yes, it is definitely a long movie, and there was some places that you could have trimmed things or streamlined stories. Now, Colin, it is your first viewing. What did you think of The Blues Brothers ultimately, now that you've had a chance to kind of talk it out with Frank, who loves this movie?
Can't hear you. I can't hear you.
I don't know. The most, I guess, like, I would just say this movie, my takeaway from the movie was, I don't get it. It's not for me. I, like we've talked about before, there's not a lot of movies I've seen that came out pre-1999. And I think going back so far, like to
1980, and especially comedy, like I was having this conversation with my wife, like drama movies from like 1980, I think they often still hold up well to me because drama is drama, but like comedy is so subjective and just changes over time that I watch this movie and I don't know why, like I don't know what's funny about it. Like I loved that the condom thing at the beginning, and then I don't think I laughed again. Okay. I think like I didn't understand
what was funny about it, and yeah, like you said, Sean, like music wise it's not really my style of music, and I just don't think I appreciated the cameos. I could imagine at the time this movie came out, like I said before, they would have been more relevant and people probably would have thought like it was super cool.
Yeah.
But watching it now is just kind of like, okay, like sure. So yeah, there's that aspect of just, yeah, I just think
the movie is too, I'm too far removed from it and it just doesn't fit my sensibility. So I don't think it just didn't really capture my attention at all.
Yeah.
I mean, looking at the story wise, I think we've covered it pretty well. Like there is just a lot of things that like logically don't add up. It seems like they put things in and then forgot about them and there was no payoffs. I think if there was one thing that this movie was really missing for me was there was no concrete antagonist. Like even the police, like John Candy and all that, like it never really seems like the Blue Brothers give a shit about them.
Yeah.
Or like really trying to avoid them at all except to not get caught before they can pay the tax fee at the end. Mm-hmm. But it's like it could have used a little bit more of them. Either, yeah, having somebody that they needed to get the money before they do, or that they needed to, I mean, I guess theoretically they needed to get the money before they got thrown back in prison, but that's never really at the forefront of the story.
Yeah.
But they could have used something like that where maybe they were a little bit, make it a little bit more obvious that they're kind of on the run and trying to lay low while they get this like heist done, basically, like give it more of a heist feel.
Yeah, because they're always on the run, yet they're driving around slowly through the town with a giant megaphone on the top of their car announcing where they're going to be. And it's mm-hmm. just like, so they're hiding in plain sight, like, but they're yeah. not being inconspicuous.
Yeah, definitely not.
Honestly, the only theory I have to that, and as silly as it sounds, it's just because they know that they're not going to get caught because they're on a mission from God. That's all yes. I can think about in that case. I'm sorry. It's cheesy, but that's what I think.
No, that's got to be what it is. Yeah, they feel like they're untouchable. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, what you say about the weirdness that the movie can have at times, I mean, we discover that a lot with John Landis movies that we've done on this show, where we like them up to a point. You know, like there's the point where Three Amigos went on this really weird tangent with them searching for the singing bush and everything, you know, and we're mm-hmm. like, or there's the scene in Trading Places where all of a sudden they're on the train doing this weird heist. Like there's always this wackiness to John Landis comedies and we're not connecting with any of it very well at all, but I can totally understand with what you say about, you know, the evolving tastes of comedy. I can understand why this isn't clicking with you either when I look at how much those didn't click with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Frank, bring us home strong. Why is this still your favorite movie of all time? Or has that opinion changed?
Well, you know, I will have to say with Colin, you know, I completely understand where you're coming from, you know, because I know a lot of people don't enjoy this movie as some people do. But, you know, as someone who grew up listening to a lot of old school music, knowing who all those people are in the first place because of that, and knowing just about the gist of the film in general before really starting to look into it and enjoy it. And I know exactly what you're saying about the comedy thing and like all the logistic stuff, but to me, with all the non-logic, that's just what makes it fun. you know. Okay. And that's kind of why I enjoy it. You know, I applaud its silliness, and I applaud, you know, the music. I applaud the acting. I applaud, well, the story maybe not so much now, but but you know, this is still in my top five of favorite movies. And honestly, it's just a feel good movie. I always feel good after watching it. It's a comfort film for me, you know. Yeah. And we all need those. So I still love it.
Yeah, I wish there had been more threads tying things together, because like it fell a little flat for me, but I didn't hate it. I did enjoy seeing it again myself. Yeah. So
yeah, I think the thing that kind of threw me was there's something about how, to that one reviewer's point, like the thing about it being a feel good film is an interesting point, and it's something like a lot of people bring up in the reviews I read, but I don't understand it, because I get like, is the feel good like, hey, they saved the day? But it's like they're too aloof, and I guess maybe that's what like the Blues Brothers is supposed to be.
Yeah,
I'm assuming, but I just found it kind of odd that aspect of it, because, and maybe there's something to the sunglasses as well. I was reading another review that was saying like how, because they're always wearing sunglasses, you can't get like the facial performance that, you know, half of acting is, right?
The windows are the eye to the soul.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So it's just kind of like, I found it really hard to connect with them, because they're just so either just like really flat,
yeah,
or like so far off the wall, but never really like emotive.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, someone that can do some pretty serious sunglasses acting. I mean, I'll bring it back to Hugo Weaving in The Matrix.
Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. Like he can do some serious facial acting even with sunglasses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, another thing I'd like to point out, really, the Blues Brothers are still somewhat of a cultural phenomenon here in the United States. Dan Aykroyd and Jim Belushi, John's brother, go about and perform sometimes. Matter of fact, my parents saw them one time in the early 2000s in Reno, Nevada. And I remember that when I was watching the movie, I was talking to my dad, like, Dad, you saw Dan Aykroyd and Jim Belushi, right? He's like, yeah. And they still go around and do Blues Brothers with most of the members of the band that are from the film. Some are unfortunately deceased, but Blue Lou Marini, the saxophonist, is still there. And Steve Colonel Cropper, legendary guitarist, he wrote Sitting on the Dock of the Bay by Otis Redding, and he, matter of fact, he just released a new album called Fire It Up, and it was nominated for a Grammy Award, so he's still making music.
Does John Goodman tour with them too?
I think he did when the movie was out, Blues Brothers 2000. Okay. I don't think he does as much now, but
yeah,
you know, they performed at the Super Bowl to promote that movie. It was John Belushi, John Goodman, and Dan Aykroyd, along with the band, and James Brown was there. So, yeah, he's done performing with them, but I don't think he does as much now.
Yeah, well, see, because now if he toured with them, now Dan Aykroyd is the fat guy. Because I saw Ghostbusters Afterlife. And now I've seen John Goodman on the Connors. Well, there we go. That is the Blues Brothers. Oh, boy. A big, huge thank you to our buddy from San Francisco, Frank Driscoll. Frank, plug your shit.
Well, I am the host of a podcast called Frankfully Honest. I am on a bit of a break of episodes right now, but I have 75 episodes you can listen to at any time. And I am currently experimenting with live radio off the app Amp, which is a brand new app. You can find it on the App Store. And if you do download it, there is a link in my bio on Instagram, at Frank W. Driscoll. And just use the code TUNEIN, all caps, to make an account. Follow my page, because I'm always experimenting with many things involving my voice. So follow me on Instagram as well and see what I'm up to.
Yeah, I was excited to hear your football commentating journey that you talk about on Frankfully Honest.
Yes. Yes, I'm getting right back to that in September. I was a little worried that they wouldn't invite me back. I don't know why. I just had a weird feeling. So I texted one of the coaches, and I was like, you want me back? Right? He's like, Frank, of course we want you back. Right on.
right on.
One day there's going to be a sign on the, like, when it says welcome to San Francisco, and it'll be like home of Frank Driscoll, the voice of who knows what. But I mean, that voice cannot go without being on the air somewhere.
Thank you, Colin.
Well, if you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out is, well, why not become a producer of the show? Go over to patreon.com/iuselectthisone, become a part of our Patreon family, and get a shout out because you're an executive producer just like Joshua Blum. Or if you don't want to give us money, but you want to help us out, why not go to whatever app you use to listen to your podcast to and give us some stars? How about 5 of them? 5's a good number. That's a great number. Some stars and a review, they just help drive us up the charts, help us get noticed on all the algorithms out there. Or if you just want to tell somebody, that even goes a far way for a podcast. Say, hey, there's this show that I listen to. It's about movies. You like movies. Why not listen to the show? It's a couple of cool, handsome, modest hosts, you know, and they bring in cool guys like Frank Driscoll. You know, like, listen to the show. Just tell somebody. Word of mouth is so important for a podcast trying to find an audience.
And be sure to check out our website, www.iuselectthisone.com. There you can find links to all of our podcast episodes, as well as our social media. And if you would like to, you can also email us at iuselectthisone@gmail.com and let us know what movies you used to like, and then maybe you'll find us talking about them on the show.
I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening, and join us next time when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.